Hello and welcome to the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James Stancil. And today we have the author of Mainstreaming Black Power, Tom Adam Davies. Coming from across the pond in the UK, he is a lecturer in American history at the University of Sussex. And he talks about the Black Power movement and how, you know, the movement itself may be viewed a bit differently. If you read his work there, that is some, you know, more mainstream, and the ideals of economic empowerment and such may be more associated with conservatism than with liberalism and radicalism. So check out this interview and see what you think there. And I think you'll enjoy this talk I have with Tom Adam Davies. So listen in. Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is James Stancil and I'm your host on the African American Studies channel. I have the pleasure of being here today with the author of Mainstreaming Black Power, Tom Adam Davies. He is a he's a lecturer in American history at the University of Sussex, and his book is published by the University of California Press. And some of you may be saying, Sussex, which state is that in? Well, he's coming from across the pond, as we say today. I've got a string of UK writers, scholars, and researchers, and Dr. Davies is yet another. So hello, Dr. Davies. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you, James. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
It is my pleasure. And again, his book is Mainstreaming Black Power. And if you don't mind, Tom, maybe can you tell us a little bit about your background, personal, professional, whatever you'd like to share, and what led you to your interest in this topic in your book?
Sure, yeah. Well, I suppose when I think about how I ended up studying what I study, it's probably from when I was at University of Leeds, which is a city in the north of England.
Right.
And I actually hadn't really studied American history proper until the second year.
Okay.
At school. School kids today in the UK, they study civil rights history quite often in school. But back then, not that long ago. It was only something you'd ever study at university. But so in the second year, I did a 20th century U.S. history course and wrote an essay on Martin Luther King and nonviolence in the civil rights movement.
Okay.
And then from that, I then in my final year did a special subject all about the civil rights movement and and I kind of fell into it from there. Specialized in. In the African American freedom struggle and kind of U.S. politics more broadly from there. So.
Okay, so yeah, so you found some interest there, and the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, I was a very lucky man. Yeah. I wrote my dissertation on SNCC,
okay.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, I interviewed some former activists, and became so engrossed with this organization, so kind of. Awestruck with what they did, but it just kind of sucked me into American history, and luckily I'm here today doing it for jobs. So.
Yes, so sucked you in. Yes, American history has a way of doing that.
Indeed, it does.
We've had some interesting times, and for the record, don't let Tom fool you. He's a very very young man, very. Very spry and active with a nice cool beard, much cooler than mine. So we're going to have to talk about that offline, Tom, and maybe you can give me some tips on how to grow my beard out a little bit like that.
I would be happy to.
And so, of course, for regular listeners, obviously, you know, this is a podcast, but you can go to our blog page, New Books Network, the African American Studies channel, and you can see some information there about Tom Adam Davies. You'll be able to see his lovely picture there, and you can click right through from that blog page, and you can purchase his book, Mainstreaming Black Power, on Amazon, our partners at Amazon. So in addition to listening to our outstanding conversation here in this podcast, you can go through and purchase his book as well. I'm sure, Dr. David, you'd be okay with that, right?
That would be very much okay with me.
Okay,
sure.
Absolutely. So, Tom, thank you for sharing some about your background and how you got interested in, you know, American history and, we can talk a little bit more here about what your book is all about, Mainstreaming Black Power. Now, a lot of us know about Black Power and the term Black Power and the raised fist. And people think about sure. Black Panther Party and some of those kinds of things. But what specifically are you writing about here? Because we're talking about mainstreaming Black Power, which is when people think about that Black Power movement, don't necessarily think about it in a mainstream way.
Yeah, and I mean, that's really the entire point, right? So you talked about the Black Panther Party, and I think if you ask the average person to think of something related to Black Power, they probably would think of the Black Panthers first, mm-hmm. right? Because there's such a strong identification, association with them. And with that, part of that is the assumption, I think, that Black Power was something that was always radical, mm-hmm. that was by definition radical. And of course, you know, much of the Black Power movement was very radical, but this book is trying to challenge the idea that it was innately radical and to say, well, actually, plenty of African Americans understood Black Power very differently. Okay. And not just African Americans, but plenty of white politicians tried to foreground an understanding, a vision of Black Power that was all about reinforcing mainstream middle class values. Mm-hmm. So it's not about revolution or redistributing wealth. Of power to kind of oppressed masses, you know, as the Black Panthers would kind of envisage Black Power, but rather it was about Blacks being able to own their own homes and own their own businesses, and the ability of individual African Americans to achieve rather than African Americans as a group. So a more kind of socially and economically conservative vision of Black progress that was all about middle class values of ownership. Private property, small government as well. The book is essentially about how mainstream white politicians and institutions reacted to the emergence of Black Power, mm-hmm. you know, when this slogan emerges in mid-66, and their efforts to try and use it as a way to reinforce the existing status quo, and really to offer the opportunity for some African Americans to become part of that American political and economic mainstream, but in a way that really ultimately only deepens inequality. Or at least this is one of the things I argue.
Yeah, that you found in your research. Sure, absolutely. Wow. Yeah, and you know, often when people think about Black Power and I guess one of the descendants like the Black Lives Matter and some of those kind of things, they instantly think of like raving liberalism and progressive views and ideals, but you know, just like you just discussed here, Tom, if they research it, African Americans, Black people are not monolithic, and you know, they have very many different perspectives, and they're all over the political spectrum, and particularly race. Yeah, and what you found in your research, and what knowledgeable people know, even like in a religious setting, in what we call the Black Church, is generally considered to be more conservative, in a lot of their ideals or viewpoints.
I think that's so important that hits the nail on the head, because I think there still is a tendency to view and to treat the African American community as if it is one kind of undifferentiated monolithic group, as if just because African Americans share a racial identity that they must all share the same values.
Right.
It's just simply not the case. And Black Power offers a great example of that. That some African Americans understood it completely differently to others. But if you look at the history and historiography of Black Power, it really is defined by ideas of radicalism. But I think there's more to Black Power than just the Black Panthers, as important as they were.
Sure.
And that's kind of what the book is trying to say. This is what else we can incorporate into the history of Black Power. Maybe we need to look at Black middle class success during the late 60s and 70s and say, well, this is part of Black Power for different reasons and in different ways.
Mm. Right, because it's literally, you're gaining Black Power. Literally.
Well, absolutely. That's, for some people, Black Power was purely that. It was just more economic power, more cultural empowerment, but it didn't mean that you had to be interested in revolution, you hated the government or the state or the police. Quite the contrary, you could be deeply invested in all those things and want to be have more of a share of American capitalism rather than want to blow American capitalism up.
Right. Absolutely. And so, Tom, can you maybe take a few minutes? Because we have a lot of young scholars and maybe community people who listen, and I like to take some time and let the researchers, scholars, and authors and academics maybe talk about what your research methods were. How'd you go about collecting your data and the things that you analyze in your work here?
Sure. Well, So I was very fortunate to be able, obviously, to come over to the US to conduct a lot of my primary research. I think I was there for about 6 months in total.
Okay.
And obviously the book looks at, well, three kind of cities in particular, New York, Los Angeles, and Atlanta. But it kind of brings them together within a story of national politics as well. So I was very fortunate to spend a lot of time in New York and LA and Atlanta. And there, I was in archives, various different archives at universities and public libraries. A lot of the stuff I was looking at were community group records.
Okay.
So a lot of, kind of individual activists, also African-American politicians' papers. So the first chapter of the book looks at the war on poverty, which is a kind of really important starting point.
Okay, right.
And the war on poverty, fortunately, has some pretty good records. And so it's through that you can get to these kind of amazing community-level formations that were created all over the U.S. And that was a way into the history of groups who otherwise really you just don't read about them. They're kind of, it's only recently that they've actually kind of become represented in the historiography of the period. But so there's a lot of oral histories as well, a lot of media, so not just but you know kind of white mainstream media, but also African American and other minority press organizations as well.
Right, newspapers and such.
Yes, I mean there's some amazing places, as I'm sure you'll know, like the Schomburg Center in New York.
Right.
Was remarkable, incredible collections there. I had the pleasure of going down to the Robert Woodruff Library at the Atlanta University Center.
Which was great.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And in Los Angeles, there's lots of different places, but there's a Southern Californian Library for Social Research, which is down in the kind of, South Central area.
Okay.
Has an amazing library with incredible collections of local organizations, and it's got black newspapers going back to the early 20th century, late 19th century.
Wow.
So, yeah. I tried to get quite a broad range of sources, but it really is, I guess, trying to give a voice to community-level activism and top-level politics as well, and kind of bringing those two things together. So,
cool. Yeah, thank you for sharing. And, you know, these resources that you just heard Tom mention are readily available for anyone, you know. He's in the East Coast, he's in the South, he was on the West Coast. These are all facilities and, you know, museums and libraries that, you know, any of us could walk in and, you know, access some of these things. So you don't have to be writing a book like Tom or, you know, being an academic if you want to know about your history and your past and, you know, the newspapers and the black media, like Tom mentioned, in your area. Definitely go in and take a look at those things. You may find some of your relatives are mentioned in some of these articles or some of your neighborhoods. You also heard Tom mention that he did oral histories. You know, we can all take the time to interview some of our older relatives. And you've heard me mention on the podcast before that, you know, people from some of these important time periods are passing away. They're disappearing before our eyes. So we definitely need to listen to their stories and to, you know, document and acknowledge their past contributions to history. It could be an important person, you know, to the community, or it could be your own relative, your uncle or your aunt or something. You may be surprised when you talk to them what they were involved in and what they found out. Every cell phone, you know, pretty much smartphone, has a microphone on it. So maybe at a family gathering or something, record one of your older relatives and ask them about what they were involved with. And they may have been involved with the Black Panther Party or one of these other organizations that Tom mentions in his text, that he found through his research. So definitely do that. You know, you don't have to be a scholar from the UK like Dr. Davies. You can be a local community researcher or scholar. Or anyone, or you can become the next Tom Adam Davies if you're a young person. Make your contribution, make your mark on society and history. Don't just leave it to someone else, right? We're the person that we're waiting for. I'm sure you would agree, Tom.
it's so important. You know, that's exactly, if you don't preserve the voices of ordinary people, that's what gets lost further down the line.
Right.
So yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Right. And just like your interest was piqued in American history, someone else's can be as well, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So tell me about how long, you know, if you could just estimate, you know, to complete this work, you know, how long do you think it, you know, it took you from beginning to end?
So it was. So this is what I did. This was my kind of PhD doctoral research project, which I think I arrived in the US first time August 2010. And then I think I basically finished the project as a PhD just before, by that late 2013.
Okay.
And then I started a job here, the University of Sussex. Yeah. And then since then, it's been a case of trying to improve the manuscript and then obviously get it in with the press, which I was very fortunate to be with University of California Press. And things always move slowly in academic publishing. So
yes, they do. Yes,
nothing goes at a good speed. But yeah, then I've added an epilogue to the book as well to try and reflect on some of the... you know, the Obama administration and some of the things that have happened in the last, since the 80s, really. Because the book kind of stops off in the late 70s, early 80s. I was trying to think about how black political power has changed since then, and or not, as the case may be. But yeah, so I guess now it's out, it's published in the last couple of months in the US. So just under 7 years was the journey. So. It's very pleasing to see it finally.
Yes,
in print.
Your baby has been born, Tom.
Indeed.
Right, and you know we often I ask this question of the scholars on the show, and yes, very often the average answer I would say is between 7 to 10 years. Be it dissertation work like yours, or maybe a later research project in an academic's career. So this is not something that you can just start and end. There's, in 6 months, there's lots of, if you heard Tom mention, starts and stops, lots of hurry ups and lots of waiting.
That's it, yeah.
But
it's a bit, you're right. It's you do have peaks and troughs, and it's amazing though to as a sense of. A project will take that long to say, to do the research, to then write it up. Writing's a hard thing to do, and it takes practice and time. So, but a very rewarding thing. So, yeah,
absolutely. And to be doing something good that, like you did here in mainstreaming Black Power, and, you're kind of giving something to the community and enlightening people on maybe some aspects of history that they may not be as familiar with. And so,
I hope so.
you did, Tom. So congratulations to you for this great work. And it's mainstreaming Black Power, and it's published by University of California Press. And of course, we're here with the author, Tom Adam Davies. He's a lecturer in American history at the University of Sussex. And of course, I'm your host, James Stansel. We're on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. And Tom, let's talk a little bit about a minute about the title itself. Is this a title that you chose, or was it something that you negotiated with the with the publishers?
That's the one that I chose.
Good.
And yeah, I think it kind of does what it needs to do, because it is a sense that the book is really about how Black Power became incorporated into the American political economic mainstream, or at least how an idea of it became incorporated, and ultimately it finishes with Black politicians in the 70s and 80s, Tom Bradley in Los Angeles and Maynard Jackson in Atlanta in particular, who's become part of a political establishment and ultimately pursue policies that have only widened inequality in those communities in the decades since. So I guess it's not... the overall learning message isn't a particularly positive one. I'm not offering a lot of hope for the future, but it is to try and suggest that there are also other ways. The politicians today in the US need to move away from the kind of policies that have helped to deepen inequality. But that's a process that began in the late 60s and 70s, a shift away from certain values to a new set of values, which have ultimately had pretty deleterious impact on American cities and the communities that live within them.
I mean, and this is an interesting, perspective, and I hope a lot of people will, read your book or become familiar with it, because, it's something seriously to think about. I mean, you've got the documentation there, and you've done your research, and that, maybe there's a different way, a different path to success, than what, you know, is, you know, that has been followed or that we've been following, you know, in the black community in terms of leadership. So certainly there's a space for your scholarship, Tom, you know, and others as well. I mean, I think the complete picture, you're going to have to look at all these different kind of things, you know, if you want to have more success in the 21st century. You know, absolutely. And what about your cover, Tom? I love the cover. Can you tell us a little bit about the design?
Yeah. Well, that's I had an idea for what I wanted to look like, and so the idea is you've got the kind of classic Black Power salute fist,
right? The fist, right?
But then the arm is kind of as if they're wearing a suit that which the American flag is on the sleeve. So.
Right.
Yeah, the idea that it was meant to look like a suit sleeve, an arm in a suit,
gotcha.
Which then, of course, implies kind of business and mainstream American society.
Mainstream.
But yeah, luckily I have a friend who's a graphic design artist who was able to make it look much better than
your vision.
Yeah, I gave him a very crude kind of picture that I'd drawn and said, can you make this look good? And he did. His name's Paul Hainsworth, and he did a great job. So,
all right. Shout out to Paul.
Yes, indeed. Shout out to Paul. So, yeah, he's done a great job. So, yeah, I think it looks great, actually. And if anyone, you know, is willing to judge a book by its cover, then this is the book to judge by its cover. So.
Judge it by its cover, right? Well, yeah. You know, a lot of times for, you know, books that are read by popular audiences, as you know, Tom, they definitely judge it by the cover. And so this is a good one. So it wasn't done in-house by anyone at the press. It was by a person that you found. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Right. It worked out really, really well. So, yeah, it's great. Because I know sometimes other people, that you don't actually have control over what goes on this book. Technically, when you sign the book contract, it then goes to the press, as you say. They normally get to do what they want. But in this instance, I sent them the image, and they said, okay, it was good.
Right. I've talked to, you know, different writers on the show, exactly what you just said, Tom. Once you sign the contract, you've kind of signed over everything, you know, book title or creative control of the cover. But oftentimes, you know, people who work in the publishing industry, they have a good idea. They are knowledgeable about those things.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Well, and UCP has been fantastic. So I've been very fortunate the whole way through.
Yeah. But, you know, in this case, you know, you chose, you know, the title, and they approved it, as well as, you know, you had one of your colleagues, one of your mates there that did a great job with the cover. So that's good. So it's a different process with every book, you know. And, you know, for a long time listening to the channel, you've heard some of the writers talk about their struggles in that area or how, you know, they had great ideas that came from the press or the, you know, the graphic design of the in-house office. So it's always different. There's no one way that it's done or one correct way. It just depends on each book and each project, and it can be a little different each time. So that's great, Tom. You got a lot of control in this one here. So that's good.
No, it worked out really, really well. So I couldn't be happier with the final product, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's good. And so, right, you know, you mentioned that your book kind of drops off a little bit through the 80s there, which I think about that too, you know, just as myself a student of studying American history, it seems like there was that big change there. So it's like things kind of slowed down or just kind of disappeared or dissipated. People kind of put down their protest hats and you know, and kind of went a different way. You know, do you think now that we're in the 21st century, you know, are things kind of returning to those past methods and movements, or you know what do you think in terms of where we are now in 2017 and, you know, what we'll see in the future?
Sure. Yeah. Look, that's it's something that I think about quite a lot. You know, I think a lot of the biggest books that were written about civil rights were by people who lived during it.
Sure. Sure.
And of course, it only becomes clear in retrospect just how seismic those events really are. Obviously,
right.
I'm sure at the time it would seem very important, but it's, you know, we are now living through an age where it feels like there's been a kind of rebirth to not just African-American, but kind of broader social movements in the US, but especially the Black Lives Matter movement is a real kind of step change. And who knows, you know, in 30, 40 years, you know, we might be looking back and having documentaries and, you know, lots of memoirs of people involved in the Black Lives Matter movement now. And I think the remarkable thing is that the kind of things that they're talking about, you know, economic inequality, institutional racism, mm-hmm. these kind of things, were basically scrubbed from the agenda since the 1980s. They're very kind of powerful, conservative-shaped media narratives about inequality and racism in the U.S. that
right.
reframed, you know, black poverty as a result of failings in the black community, or, you know, institutional racism couldn't exist anymore because mm-hmm. America had moved beyond race. And,
right. Post-racial
like
America.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, this has been an ideology that's been funded by conservative think tanks and expounded in, you know, the Hoover Institute and the Manhattan Institute and all these kind of conservative strongholds. And they're being challenged now. And they've been challenged explicitly and forcefully, and they've been completely debunked, well, at least in the minds of many people.
Sure.
This does feel like a rebirth of activism in the U.S. It feels like a crucial time. Good question, and it's very encouraging to see the Black Lives Matter has gone from being, you know, from beginning, I guess, with a particularly strong focus on mm-hmm. You know, racial disparities in the criminal justice system, which of course it still is focused on, but now they have a much broader mm-hmm. political agenda.
Right.
It's going to be fascinating to see how they push that forward, this kind of anti-GOP, anti-Trump resistance agenda, which, look, I mean, America needs that, I think, because the GOP and Trump are trying to do some fairly horrendous things, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the kind of healthcare bill that's going through now, which looks like it's going to get passed without anyone knowing anything about it, is so anti-democratic and so morally troubling that it's just a great thing that there are people like Black Lives Matter who are trying to fight this kind of politics, and hopefully they'll get more and more people supporting them in the future. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, everything has to start somewhere, right? And they're working on being a movement as opposed to just a moment.
And, yes, absolutely.
And they often say, you know, one of my favorite expressions is that history may not repeat, but it often rhymes.
Absolutely, yeah. And so true.
And let me also say that the views expressed by Tom Adam Davies on the New Books Network are not necessarily the views of the channel or Dr. Marshall Poe or any of the hosts, though they very well may be, but not necessarily. But yeah, that's a great point that you make there, you know, Tom, and you know, it very well may be you, Tom Adam Davies, writing about the Black Lives Matter movement in 30 or 40 years, you know?
Yeah, well, I think it's an amazing movement now, and yeah, it's the future of black protest, isn't it? So, but the future of protest in general.
Right. In the internet age, you know?
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, that's, in many ways, it makes what was done in the 60s and 70s even more impressive.
Mm-hmm.
When I think about, you know, today, obviously, social media has really, as you've suggested, completely transformed activism. But imagine back in the 60s, you had to agree to do things and then meet in
right.
a certain place. You couldn't just text message someone or you know, tweet them, or you couldn't get up a whole load of activists and people online by sending a single tweet and a hashtag. You had to go and, you know, pound the pavement and knock on doors and you know, get people to commit. And yeah, it's amazing in its own way, but it makes me think about the past and just how different it must have been.
I mean, there's some benefits to the technology, of course, but there's also some detriments as well, you know, because
sure.
there is not the connectivity. You have more connectivity in a sense, but like you said, you don't have the connectivity where people are sitting there together and planning and really, you know, kind of everyone's on the same page. You know, you don't have it that way. You know, Black Lives Matter is pretty much anybody can go out there and say, I'm Black Lives Matter.
You know? Yeah. And, which presents its own problems, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, because people who are opposed to maybe the, you know, the ideology and some of the things will label anyone who's doing anything that they don't like as a Black Lives Matter person.
Yeah.
And anyone can get out there and do that. When as you mentioned, and you know, you talk about in your book that, you know, you had people who you were organized back in the 60s and the 70s, you know, you got together and you had formal movements with formal leaders and such, even if it was, you know, in the local level. But now anybody can get out there and just, you know, throw on a hashtag and say they're doing you know, whatever. So it will be interesting, like you said, Tom, to see kind of, you know, what falls out from this and where we are, if we're still around.
Yeah.
That is a bit in question as well. In 20 or 30 years. So maybe we'll be getting mainstreaming Black Power 3 or 4 from 4th edition. Yes. From Tom Adam Davies, at that point. We'll have to see. And we might be talking to each other again. We may have a little more gray there, Tom, but we still may be on the New Books Network talking about some of these issues, which I would love for you to, you know, come back anytime. You know, you have a work or anything that you want to talk about. I think that would be, you always have an open invitation on my show and on my channel, Tom, so you don't have to worry about that.
That's great. Yeah, it'd be a pleasure.
Yeah. And on that note, I know that you have to catch a train to London here pretty soon.
Indeed.
So I don't want to hold you, but for so long. And again, we're here with the author of Mainstreaming Black Power, Tom Adam Davies, and he is a lecturer in American history at the University of Sussex. And he's going to be catching a train to London shortly, so we're not going to hold him too much longer on the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. But I did want to give you a chance, Tom, if you could just maybe share with the audience some of your current work or your current research or things that you plan on doing in the future. Maybe for a few minutes, if you can share those things for us.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, so I guess the things I'm doing now are finishing two articles that I have.
Okay.
That I'm finishing. The first is looking at the war on poverty in New York.
Okay.
So this is when, and really it's looking at John Lindsay, who was the mayor in New York from the 66 through to 73, and how his approach to the war on poverty kind of transformed city and state politics.
Okay.
So I had the real privilege and honor of interviewing a politician called Major Owens, who was a congressman and senator. He sadly passed away now, but we spoke for several hours about the war on poverty in New York, which, you know, he got his break in politics.
Right, so he was actively involved.
He was, yeah. He ended up actually leading the New York kind of city department that headed up the war on poverty.
Mm-hmm.
But talking to him, I realized that actually nearly every African-American representative in state assembly in the mid-1970s mm-hmm. had taken a similar route. They'd all gone through the war on poverty.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, the article is kind of about the war on poverty and how it impacted on minority politics in New York and the role that Lindsay played in that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the nearest one to be completed. And then after that, I've got a second article that I need to do more work on, but is kind of moving in the right direction, which is it kind of builds on some of the themes I've talked about, and it's about the 1968 Mexico City Olympics.
Okay.
Yeah, so what do you think, and as I'm sure you and all your listeners will be very familiar with Tommy Smith and John Carlos's Bat Power Salute in that, which obviously is such an iconic moment of 1960s history,
sure.
And especially of kind of Black Power history. But I think most people wouldn't know about the counter-protest that young George Foreman, who was a 19-year-old amateur heavyweight at that Olympics, who won the gold against a Russian opponent in the final. And this is about 3 days after Smith and Carlos's protest. But after his victory, he gets a couple of U.S. flags from his trainer and starts walking around the ring talking about United States power.
Mm-hmm.
And so the article looks at these two kind of moments of protest and their aftermath, because when they get back home, I think the assumption is that Smith and Carlos were seen as heroes for what they did, but actually the more I looked into it, the less that's true.
Right.
And you read more interviews with Smith and Carlos and you realize that they were kind of ostracized by many, many people, black and white. Whereas Foreman was criticized by some kind of Black Power militants like Carmichael and A. Crap Brown and people like that, but actually was celebrated by many African Americans and certainly by white America. So it's thinking about the two contrasting receptions that these athletes all received, and what does that tell us about, I guess, black political culture at that time, and questions of radicalism and patriotism and things like that. And also about athletes as well, because I think about Colin Kaepernick today and the way that he's being treated by the NFL and, you know, what is the price of protest.
Protest, right.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, there's a lot. I need to do more thinking on that, but that's the next one.
That's a nice book title right there, Tom. The Price of Protest.
Yeah. You don't write that down.
just give me a shout out somewhere in there for that, you know.
Oh, but, of course, yeah, don't worry.
the Price of Protest. Yeah, I like that. That sounds pretty interesting. And you're right, you know, and that kind of goes with what we've been talking about, Tom, and that the African American community is not monolithic. You know, you have many different, you know, ideals and perspectives. And you know, I'm familiar with that George Foreman piece, and it's just interesting how he's evolved over time. You know, as you know, being you know a big American guy then, and then he was like this mean, evil, you know, Texan, and then he's the lovable, you know, father, you know, grandfather hawking his grills.
Yeah. Well, he's the American dream, right? It's made himself this multimillionaire success story, and he loves being American. But you're right, it is absolutely, again, it's not, it's trying to understand the black community as not being this monolithic group. You have to dig deeper to really understand what was happening.
And, you know, and we have a bit of revisionist history with Muhammad Ali and with Carlos and Smith and those folk. You know, they were hated at the time, and now we're like, oh, they were great American heroes. But, as you mentioned, that was not the universal view at the time.
And, no. Far from it, yeah.
And I had,
especially with Ali.
I had the pleasure of being at a conference with Tommy Smith. I mentioned to you offline, I was at a conference in New Orleans, and I had the pleasure of being with him, and he was helping out with the morning exercises each day during the conference. So that was nice. You know, I didn't realize you were going to mention him, you know, specifically with your future project. Yeah, but he was there, and it, you know, did, you know, remind me of his situation, and you hear a lot more about Carlos, than you do about Smith and what they did in 1968. So yeah, I'm looking forward to reading those, Tom, when you get those out. Yeah, maybe let me know, and you know, and I can publicize it and let people know
fantastic.
About it. And and if you find out where it's going to be, you know, where they're going to be published, and certainly let us know, because we like to support those who support us on the New Books Network, and you know, our authors and scholars. And if people want to reach out to you, Tom, you know, maybe if they were involved in some of these movements, or you know, they read your, you know, to read your book, and they want to get in contact with you, maybe share some things. How can they do that?
Well, yeah, I'd love to hear from anyone who would want to get in touch about the book or anything. So you could email me on my work email, which is t.a.davies, D-A-V-I-S, at sussex.ac.uk.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm on Twitter, at Tom Adam Davies. Either would be good. So yeah, it'd be great to hear from people.
All right, absolutely. So if you're a person who's involved in some of these movements, or you know, you like some of the things, or you wanted to talk with Tom about some of the things of this book, because as Tom knows, you never know where that next book or research project is coming from.
Absolutely, yeah.
It could come from an email or someone that's listening right here today. So don't be shy if you have some things you want to share with the author, Tom Adam Davies. And on that note, we're going to let Tom go, because he's got to get on his train and get back home to London after a day's work. The book is Mainstreaming Black Power. The author is Tom Adam Davies. He's a lecturer in American history at the University of Sussex. Tom, thank you so much for taking time with us on the African American Studies channel on the New Book Network. And, you know, this is an interesting work here that Tom has put together. So definitely check it out. Thank you again, Tom. And if you could say goodbye to our audience and America and around the world, we're going to let you go.
Thank you very much, James. It was great to speak to you. And yeah, goodbye to everyone.
All right. Thank you so much, Tom, and we will see you next time. Again, the book is Mainstreaming Black Power. Check it out. And I thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James Stansel. Peace and love. Okay, we're back on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James Stansel. Just finished up the great interview with Tom Adam Davies of the University of Sussex. Thank you so much, Tom, for spending some time with us. We called him right before he had to catch a train home to London. And so I appreciate him taking a few minutes with us and telling us about his book, the book Mainstreaming Black Power, and it's published by the University of California Press. Very interesting perspective, sir. I think you're going to enjoy. And as he said, you know, get in contact with him if you have any experiences or anything you want to share, questions you want to talk with him about his book. Definitely do that. So on that note, I'm going to end it for the day. Thank you so much for listening, and check out this podcast and many of our others on the African American Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, James Stansel. Peace and love, and we'll see you next time.